Welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. With this podcast, we want to give voices to many coastal scientists and engineers so we can meet them, at least virtually, and hear curious and less curious questions. My name is Ana Vila Concejo, and today I am having a chat with Helen Burningham, who is Professor of Physical Geography at the University College of London. Helen's research is about coastal behavior from decades to century timescales, and she has done lots of different things in open coast and in estuaries, from coastal GIS to morphodynamics and even art collaborations. I am super happy to chat with her today. Hello, Helen. How are you today?
Hi, Anna. Fine, thank you.
Okay, so I guess you know that this podcast started a bit as a reaction to the isolation that we felt during COVID. So tell me a little bit, was your work very affected by COVID?
Yeah, I mean, being an academic, the immediate impact was just purely around teaching and student support. And that was really quite challenging, I think. And we all think that we work at kind of excessive hours, but that then just went on to an entirely different level. And just the whole need to kind of make sure that everything was available all the time to all students, that to try and break down those barriers for some students who just couldn't get online properly. There were just so many challenges, and it was right there in front of you. And you had no option, but actually you didn't want to not do the job. You know, you definitely were working all the time, flat out, just to be able to try and make sure that students were able to get the right experience and get the right resources available to them. And then you had all the other side of it of actually just the basic support to students, just that, you know, students are coming into uni with having no real interactions with other students, and trying to kind of facilitate that through an online environment was just so tricky and just such hard work. I mean, I think since then the issue is that we haven't really pulled back from that level of work. It's almost as though we kind of implemented all of these new ways of working, which were quite kind of time intensive. And we haven't really pulled back on a lot of them. So it feels like we haven't really taken our foot off the pedal, even though the pandemic is kind of technically part of, you know, your normal life now, that, you know, you just have to accept we're living with it. That all of those extra measures and all that extra effort seems to still be there. It doesn't feel like we've kind of taken a step back and tried to kind of measure the way that we do things in a more moderate way. It does happen, because I don't think many of us can sustain this level of kind of working, this intensity of workload. It's not good.
And now that you are face to face, we are face to face as well, back to face to face in Australia. Do you feel that the students' expectations on the level of care and interaction have changed?
Yeah, and it's funny because it's changed in a funny way, that they want a lot of attention, a lot of time face to face, but I don't think they necessarily want it with the academics. And they like having flexibility. So they actually are demanding to have everything available online, so that everything's recorded, but also that the lectures are scheduled. So sometimes you can be going in to give a lecture, which is also available online, and actually there's only 25% of the class has turned up. So this is this kind of duplication of effort on some levels, that there's just so much extra work being done, but actually, and you know, the students are asking for it, but actually it's quite hard to see how that can be sustained in the long term, because I can't go to lots of effort to produce, you know, suitable online material, as well as also being available all the time in uni. It's, you can't do it all.
I think I'm having exactly the same experience. Let's not call it a problem. Anyway, let's go to the podcast. So we have a set of semi-fixed questions to go through in about 30 minutes. And the first one is, how did you start in coastal science?
So I did a degree in what was called combined science. And it meant that I could kind of pick and choose between different aspects of geography, environmental science, geophysics. And the main reason I did that is because I really did not like human geography. So as much as I liked physical geography, I desperately didn't want to have to do the human geography aspect of it. And I really liked maths, and it meant that I could continue aspects of maths. It was kind of trying to pull things together that I was interested in rather than anything else. But anyway, I did my degree at Lancaster, and the second year of my degree was based in Oregon State University. And I already had an interest in geomorphology generally. I loved everything about how the surface of the earth formed and the processes. And I'd loved that, since being a teenager. But being in Oregon, we obviously had field trips to the Oregon coast, which is just astounding. And I took a class with Paul Comer, who was also pretty amazing. And I remember going into the class and actually suddenly feeling that I actually wanted to do well at this. I don't think I'd had that feeling prior to that point. I worked hard, but I never had a kind of conscious feeling of I really want to do this well. And I kind of really kind of turned around the way that I worked, I suppose, and I worked hard to understand everything that was covered in that class. And I kind of came back into the UK system in my third year and took a load of extra coastal courses and was increasingly kind of embedded in coastal science. And I had Bill Carter's Coastal Environments book out from the library on kind of a perpetual loan. I just loved it. I was consuming that book as if it was a novel. Everything that was written in there, I just sucked in. I couldn't get enough of it. So even by the end of my degree, I kind of knew that I wanted to do something to do with coastal science, and that, I guess, that's what I then looked for, and then ended up doing a PhD. So that's kind of how I got into it, I suppose.
That's cool. Okay, the next question is about your life. How did you balance your life commitments, your personal life, your work life? How did you do it?
Not very well sometimes. I don't know. It's a funny thing because I think for a lot of people who don't work in academia or work in research, really don't understand how your job doesn't just start at 9 and finish at 5. And sometimes that's not a for me, it's not a bad thing because there are some aspects of my job that I absolutely love, And I love the research side of things. I love data analysis. I could do that all the time and be very relaxed and happy doing that as if it wasn't work at all. But then obviously there are other parts of work, that are just quite laborious and quite hard work. And it's when that then spills over into your kind of personal time that it just starts to be, you start to then think, oh, hang on a minute, this is just not right. But I mean, I guess the thing is that sometimes of the year the balance is there, and sometimes of the year the balance isn't there, and it's not right or wrong really. It is what it is. There are just intense periods of the year work-wise, and you just kind of, I think you have to get through it. I'm not sure that there's any way that you can not work that extra effort, certainly not in the way that academia is at the moment. And so I think as long as you can enjoyment out of some aspects of your work, particularly in the times when you're not having to do the stuff that you don't like doing, then I think I well certainly for me, I'm happy with the balance. There were sometimes though, if you'd have asked this question maybe in the middle of term time, in the middle of our term time, I probably would give a very different answer. Whereas we are literally in the quietest month of the year, it's the only month that we really get to do any proper research. So I'm actually kind of in that buoyant mode of, oh yeah, this is really fun. I really enjoy this. I'm doing lots of free fun stuff. Yeah, the answer would be quite different in December, I
Okay, maybe we need to do a second chapter with
think.
Helen. So, when you are not working, what are your interests or your hobbies? What did you like to do?
Well, I have dogs, and I've had dogs now for 10 years, and they're probably one of the main reasons I can kind of have some degree of work-life balance, because, you know, they're there and they are a great leveler. And we actually we do a lot with them, in the sense that they are fundamentally part of our life, and we do sports with them. So both of our dogs are in our local flyball teams. So flyball is a dog sport, and as in a sport for humans and dogs together, and it's a team of four dogs that basically do like a relay, and you race against other teams, and that's what we do a lot of that in our spare time. I also run with my dog, so I do canicross. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, you know, running, walking with dogs, anything related to dogs is what we basically do in our spare time, and gardening. So I really like being able to grow my own food. So that's quite a major part of our life as well. So,
well, our listeners cannot see how beautiful the plants just behind Helen look. I am deeply envious, I have to say. Okay, so the next question is about culture. So we have quite a nice culture in our little field of research of coastal geosciences and engineering and this, but there is always room for improvement. What would you change in our field of research to make it a better place?
Yes, this is a really tricky question, because I think, you know, by my point in a career, I guess what you've learned to do is kind of work with what's around you and make it work for you. So it's almost getting harder to kind of now think about what would you change if you kind of were able to kind of impose massive change on things. I've kind of learned to live with things as they are. But I know when I was starting out, I really struggled to kind of find networks and be connected with other researchers. And that's probably for a lot of different reasons. I mean, it's, you know, financially, it was just really challenging to kind of get any sort of money to do anything. And also, I suppose personally, I've never really been a kind of flamboyant person who kind of can go out and make lots of friends and kind of make lots of contacts. I'm quite shy. So I think, you know, when you combine all that in your kind of early career stages, it can feel quite lonely. You can find, you know, other people in a similar sort of situation. So I don't know what the magic bullet for that would be, really, in terms of trying to, I suppose it's more about making more opportunities for connections and networking to actually happen. And maybe now that we're so much more tuned to doing stuff online, there's maybe more opportunity for that, in the sense that you don't have to get from A to B, you don't have to travel the world to meet people. That, you know, even the seminars that started to be presented online throughout the pandemic, that in itself I felt was really nice. I mean, the Eurocoast seminar series that Kurt set up, it's been running for a couple of years now, I think, that's been brilliant. You know, just brilliant in terms of bringing people together once a month, having a talk, just, you know, and that would never have happened, I don't think, without the pandemic. And that's the sort of thing that I think we could do more of, and lots of people can benefit from. So I'm hoping that sort of activity continues, really. I don't want things to stop just because we have got kind of our normal lives back. I think there are some elements of the changes that we made during the pandemic that will really benefit a whole range of people and just make things much more accessible.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And I think that the networks for early career researchers are very important, and we should do something about facilitating that happening. So yes, that's a very good point. Okay, so now we're going back to science and research. And can you tell us about your favorite paper, or a paper that changed your research, like how you do things or your research direction?
I mean, like I mentioned, Bill Carter's book, which I think for me will always be the most important thing I've ever read, because it just opened so many and gave me such insight to so many different, I mean, Bill wrote around so many aspects of coastal morphodynamics that That it really, for me, was a kind of, I suppose, not groundbreaking, but just such a baseline of information and thinking. And I think, you know, ultimately, I've probably then gone off in that direction of, you know, using him as a baseline or his work as a baseline. And I know in the early years then, when I was, you know, working largely around kind of small coastal systems and coastal inlets, quite a lot of the work that was coming out of New Zealand by Terry Hume and I loved reading those papers, because I think when you're first starting out and you're working on a particular system, you get so embedded in the detail that you then start to think that everything's so different in your world. Like, so I was looking at a couple of estuaries, or two or three estuaries on the west coast of Ireland, and it just kept on feeling as though everything that I was looking at was different to everything else in the world. And like, how was I ever going to make any sense of any of it? Because, you know, I couldn't, it didn't fit into any of the kind of the standard models. Didn't, you know, all the work that was coming out of the States on these kind of sandy inlet systems, they just didn't describe what I was seeing. And I think at that stage in your career, it's very difficult to see that as an opportunity to say something, because actually most of the time you're like, oh my goodness, it's not working, it's not it doesn't seem to fit with anything. And that felt like a really negative thing. Obviously it's for some people who are bolder in their thinking, that's a positive, because if you can demonstrate that you've got something fundamentally different, then you've got a whole opportunity there to publish extensively, whereas I was desperately wanting to find something that was familiar. So the work that was coming out on the New Zealand inlets, which are very kind of very similar in a sense, they're kind of small sandy systems where the channels and the ebb tidal deltas are all shapes and sizes, and that suddenly gave me something to look at and think, so there are other places in the world that have these really quirky systems that have lots of really odd controls on the way that they operate. They don't just sit within these kind of straightforward relationships, because there's just too much other stuff going on. And that just gave me, I guess, a bit more confidence to recognize, you know, aspects that were the same, and therefore, you know, give me confidence in it, but also the opportunity to then think, well, actually, it's quite important to put stuff out there that demonstrates that these pre-existing models or ideas don't necessarily always work.
Mm-hmm. That's what I have to say. I shared your passion for Carter's book. It's really amazing. And I was working on tidal inlets at the time as well. And I remember the human gender dove, wasn't it? The papers.
Yes.
I was just going to move to the next question that is a little bit a continuation of this one. So it's if you can briefly explain one of your topics of research to our listeners.
Well, I suppose what a lot of the research that I've done has been trying to demonstrate is that things aren't quite so simple. I think many years ago, I got a bit fed up with the whole sea level change kind of debate, or not the debate, the kind of the fact that everybody was just constantly saying that the erosion that was happening around the coast was related to sea level rise, or the changes that were operating in a system were driven by storms. And that, you know, this tendency to kind of just chuck a big kind of mechanism at something and just say, well, that's the reason that this is happening. Because the work I've been doing in Northwest Ireland, I could just tell that these systems weren't just, you know, being driven by the storms that were coming in. And I knew that that part of the world wasn't really experiencing any significant sea level rise. And yet, during the years I was doing my PhD, I had to move my reference posts every single winter because that coast was eroding so rapidly. You know, I mean, now I know that particular period of time was a period of intense storminess. So I can kind of think back and recognize that, because I've done research on the same site since. And I know it wasn't related related to sea level rise. I know it was definitely related to enhanced periods of storming. Then starting to work on the Suffolk coast, where I was actually looking at a much larger area, so kind of about 75 kilometres or so, where I knew again that the sea level shift signature is essentially the same along that stretch of coast. And in southeast England, sea level is definitely rising. So, okay, you think that sea level is driving coastal erosion. Now on the Suffolk coast, you've got a coastline where there are areas where you've got rapid erosion that's kind of 4 or 5 meters a year. You've got areas where there's basically no change over years, two decades to even centuries. And then you've got areas that are prograding, that are building out at rates of, you know, 2 or 3 meters per year. So on this one relatively small stretch of coast, you've got every single type of coastal behaviour. Now, if sea level rise or storminess is so important, why are we seeing such variety of change on such a within a relatively small area? And I think what that has brought home to me, and I suppose what I am thinking much more about generally, is just the availability of sediment and what's controlling that availability. So, you know, sea level change, storminess, you know, they sit out there as a set of kind of forcing mechanisms that are obviously important. But actually what's more important is, where is sediment? Where can it come from? Where can it get to? What's in the way of that sediment? And how does the change in that morphology then impact the way in which things like storms are manifest, and their impact at the coast, or, you know, the impacts of sea level rise? So I mean, it's a much more kind of general maybe answer to the question, but I think I like to be able to look, kind of search for other reasons for coastal change, rather than just assuming that everything is driven by, you know, either storms or sea level rise. And it's quite interesting how in the two kind of main areas that I've worked in geographically, that's been very much the case, that it has been very, very clear in both of those locations that there are these kind of broader external forcing mechanisms are not the main drivers of change, or the main reasons for seeing the changes that we see, that the changes are being manifest in very many different ways along those stretches of coast.
That's a really good answer, and it's a really, really good point. And I also agree that the availability of sediments, the sediment availability, is so important, but yet so hard to determine, that we often just ignore it or consider it slightly. And I always say that sediment availability is kind of the elephant in the room every time we look at coastal change. So yes, that's a really good point. Okay, so now we go back to a bit of fun. You have done lots of field work. And what are the wildest field conditions that you have encountered?
Well, having done lots of field work in Northwest Ireland, I think I've probably experienced every possible weather. because when you do field work in Ireland, what you have to realise is that you are literally going to get every single season in a single day. So I remember helping one of my PhD students do some field work, and we didn't have access to a four-wheel drive vehicle, so we were having to drag this wave recorder out probably about 1 kilometre over the estuary to get it to the location we were setting it up. And in that day where we were dragging this thing along, we had hail, we had like gale force winds, we had amazing sun, that to the point that you basically had to take your layers off because it got so hot. And it was just absolutely insane. The weather was just mad. And we put this thing in, left it in for 2 weeks, came back, collected it, and the blooming battery had died. So it was a complete waste of time. I mean, honestly, if anybody had been watching us and just watching this kind of whole kind of 2 week period unfurl, I mean, honestly, they'd have thought, what on earth are these people doing? They are mad, utterly mad. Like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, the weather, in a sense, well, the wildness of it is actually one of the attractors to me. I mean, if you can get through those sorts of days, I think it kind of just means that you can get through anything in life.
I had to add here that I have only been once to Ireland, to Northern Ireland, and then to Donegal. I was there for a week or a week and a half, and it was shining. The sun was shining every day. It was perfect organization by the Gonzalo and Derek,
oh, yeah,
who organized ICS 2002. It was, and yeah, perfect organization. It was perfect weather all the time. So you know, this thing of like the all of the seasons in one day, I haven't experienced it.
I used to take my dad on fieldwork during my PhD, because whenever my dad came over, the weather was glorious, like literally.
Wow.
And yet any time I did field work without my dad, the weather was terrible. So it always became a bit of a running joke that, you know, I should get my dad over for field work because the weather would be good. So
what is the strangest thing that you have seen at the coast or at the beach or the dunes?
Well, luckily, most of the research that I do has been in environments where there aren't people, because I hear horror stories about when people are doing field work at the coast and come across a nudist beach. Which thankfully I've never had to deal with, but there are several times when I've get vehicles stuck in the beach, in the beach sand, which has obviously looked then like a very odd thing to see at the coast. There's also been, like, you know, gigantic whales washed up on the shore, which in Northwest Ireland is quite a rarity. So they've been, and you know, they've been left to kind of decay on the beach, so you see these kind of gigantic skeleton structures that are gradually emerging from these decaying, but nothing particularly interesting or exciting, actually, now that I think about it.
You might have a very high threshold to find things weird. Okay, going back to science, this is a question that we ask all of our guests. Do you think we can predict long-term morphodynamic changes beyond the Kedler scales? What do you think?
I mean, I have issues with the prediction side of things, because so much of what we do in terms of prediction is based on what we've seen happen already, and that's problematic. In a sense, you know, in a sense that what's happened, so what's there is kind of within the historical kind of envelope of variability, if you want to call it that, isn't necessarily enough of a basis to then draw from. So, you know, if you think about kind of standard approach of looking at shoreline change and looking at the historic rate of shoreline change and then just projecting that into the future based on maybe one or two other parameters, it's just not, it's, you know, I think most of us who work at the coast know that things work outside that, you know, things happen that we can't predict. I think what we can do is get a good sense of the range, you know, the range of possibilities, and certainly conceptually, I think most of us are able to kind of recognize what the possibilities of, you know, the coast in a particular location are going to be in several decades time. But I suppose, you know, maybe that's where people that do the kind of probabilistic modeling come in the sense of being able to give a bit more certainty to some of those possibilities over other ones, and that's maybe the best that we can possibly hope for, is just having a greater sense that something's more likely and something's less likely. But in terms of complete predictions of change in the future, I think it's just really tricky, really, really tricky.
Can you think of a major advance in coastal science that will happen in the next 50 years? Or is there something that you would like to see happening?
So this is funny, isn't it? Because having now been doing this for how many decades now? A couple of decades. You know, I think when I was doing my PhD, I remember always thinking, oh, I wish I had more data. I wish I had more data, because it just felt like I had no data. And that was because, you know, like several decades ago, data was hard to come by. And so I was just always wanting for more data. And then you think about now, we have tons of data. You know, there's just so much available to us now. You think about the kind of the what LiDAR can do for everybody, and even what kind of drone, if you wanted to look at it at the kind of a smaller scale, what drones can do in terms of their mapping capabilities. We're almost kind of data heavy now. And I suppose what we're now looking to is ways in which we can use that data more effectively. Because, you know, the technologies for data collection are only going to continue to improve, in which case we're going to just be utterly overloaded in terms of the amount of data, but then the ability, you know, the capability to do anything with that is where the advances are probably going to be needing to be made. And obviously lots of people are already embarking on new ways of analyzing data, working with really kind of powerful computers to do kind of much more high resolution modeling, working with machine learning, deep learning to kind of analyze these bigger data sets. And I think that's where the growth is. I suppose maybe it's going to be a growth in tandem. We'll just continue to kind of have greater capabilities in data collection, greater capabilities in the analytical side of things. But there's still going to be throughout all of that the need for being careful, I suppose, about what we can say from that data. It's very easy to kind of use these tools now because they are all very much available. You know, you don't have to be particularly competent programmatically now to be able to do these things. And it just churns out lots of answers and lots of kind of data to that kind of tells you things. But then we really do need to be very cautious about how we use that information, how we use those results, and whether they are actually meaningful or not. Because I think if you don't have that kind of critical perspective, continue to have a really critical perspective on it, it's going to be too easy to kind of just assume, you know, it's like the relating two data sets together, and just because there is a relationship, a demonstrable kind of mathematical relationship between two variables, it doesn't mean there's a causal relationship. And it's just kind of going back to that real basic recognition that, you know, the data is one thing, but being able to interpret and use and understand that data is a fundamentally different thing.
Okay, the next question, we go back to your other life. So which other contributions to society do you do through your work? You do mentoring, outreach, science communication, art collaborations?
I mean, from an academia perspective, I'm quite heavily involved in the equalities side of things. And I am very interested in understanding kind of what we can do about improving kind of inclusion and equity generally within both academia but also within research. And it's again, you know, I suppose it's like everything. It seems such an obvious thing on the surface, but when you start to look at the detail, it's quite a challenging set of situations that we have around us. In our university, we have very classic kind of leaky pipeline. So most of our undergraduate students are female, and yet as you then progress through the different levels of degree, and then go into kind of early career academia, and then up to professor, your proportion of women rapidly decline. And understanding that decline is quite difficult. It's not straightforward. You know, we've analysed it, we've looked at where the drop-offs happen, and they can happen for a number of different reasons. I mean, but even just the simple case of being based in London is less attractive, I think, to some people in terms of where they then want to base themselves later on. Maybe if they want a family, maybe they don't want to actually bring up a family in London or in and around London. I mean, there are so many different kind of drivers for those changes, and you know, you can make small changes here, there, and everywhere to try and kind of improve things, but it doesn't actually necessarily ultimately result in any systematic change. And that's where it gets really quite disheartening that you can make things better, but they won't necessarily change the bigger picture. But that's kind of from an academic perspective, I suppose. But from a wider research perspective, what I'm increasingly interested in is enabling wider communities to get involved in their own sort of coastal research. So in Suffolk, we've been doing a project to kind of, there's a few people doing kind of a citizen science sort of set of activity. What we've been trying to do is encourage that on a broader level, but also to that it's not citizen science in the kind of traditional sense of citizen science, where the public basically collects a load of data for a scientist or for a stakeholder, that actually they're collecting it for their own enhanced understanding. So we're kind of terming it more kind of community science, because these are communities that are driving their data collection, and some guidance from me to make sure that it's robust, that it's an approach that's actually going to deliver something useful. And then trying to then showcase that locally and get more people on board, and then start to broaden the sorts, different sorts of activities that people are engaged with, purely all to just generally improve people's understanding of coastal change. Because actually, it's probably the same in most countries now, that a lot of the decision making on coastal protection and coastal management is done through public consultation, or the public have a role there. And I think it's quite problematic to allow that without resourcing a support and guidance of those local communities, so that they're coming at that public consultation from an informed perspective. Because otherwise, you're just then relying on the few people that are interested and the few big voices. Whereas if you can try and raise the level of understanding across the wider community, then you're more likely to have informed communities who are more likely to make more sustainable decisions for the future. And because if we don't do that, then, you know, we're just going to be going through the same perpetual cycles of, you know, really bad decision making.
Okay, so we go to our last question, that is, what is the best or the worst or both advice that you have ever received?
I've been told many times to not write papers because they are not refable, is the term that they use here. So we have the research evaluation framework, which is done every 7 years, which assesses the research quality of universities and departments. And that process usually requires the submission of a set of outputs from a department, and those outputs are then graded. So there's a need, I suppose, to kind of make sure that you put your efforts into high quality papers, because that's what's refable, that's what you would put in for ref. And so certainly early on in my career, there was a general kind of feeling that you shouldn't bother with other papers, anything that wasn't going to be refable, it wasn't worth writing. And I think it's just utter nonsense, really, because I think any paper that's worth writing is worth writing. It's, you know, there are lots of, and actually there are lots of different avenues for writing. I think any communication of knowledge and understanding at any level, and for any audience even, is positive. We should be communicating our knowledge and understanding all the time, and in many, many different ways.
Okay, cool. So before going to our final quick questions, is there something that you would like to say that you haven't had a chance to say today?
Yeah, well, I suppose you mentioned right at the very beginning, before we were talking about this, about the funding side of things. And I think it is really challenging now for all aspects of research to really kind of get a foot on the ladder. If you're not part of a big kind of consortium, then you are struggling to find money to just do your research. And I think, you know, the way that the funding bodies are going, they seem intent on getting rid of small grants and putting everything through these big grant opportunities, because they have this idea that if you bring lots of people together, then you end up with better science and better progress. And I don't think that means that you're not funding any of the kind of core science, just the kind of regular science activities, which are often the things that provide the information and the baseline that these bigger kind of ideas can then draw from. So if you get rid of that bottom level, then you're just getting rid of the actual meat of research. So I wish somebody would turn around and recognize that, you know, a 10 grand grant, so £10,000, or, you know, would actually enable quite a lot of research. It doesn't mean that you can necessarily employ anybody, but it means you can actually do something that you couldn't do otherwise. And if lots of people were getting those smaller pots of money, a lot more just regular level research could be undertaken, which just then ultimately brings everybody along in terms of advances in research, but also gives these kind of stepping stones for these bigger ideas to kind of really have some grounding, because everything all connects together ultimately, which is why, you know, I do think that writing on any level is a good thing, because ultimately if you can get the ideas out there, then they are gradually all contributing to furthering science more generally. But then we are all part of it, as opposed to it just being dominated by a few discrete groups of people who just happen to always get the big pots of money.
Yeah, I think I really agree with you. I think that the importance of seed funding is often understated, like the importance of seed funding these small grants that you get to work with one more person or something like that. And then you end up creating networks and that can lead to the larger grants. But I really agree with you. I think that's something that is very close to my heart too. Okay, cool. So now we're going to go to our final quick questions. Just to wrap up, don't think too much. Just tell me the first answer that comes to your mind. No judgment. So the first one, favorite band, music or composer?
Well, I suppose at the moment, I really love First Aid Kit, which is a band, a Scandinavian band. But then if I kind of look over the longer term, I absolutely love Joni Mitchell.
Favorite dish or signature dish?
Bean burritos.
Oh, nice. The latest book you have read?
I'm reading This Is Happiness at the moment by, I think, Niall Williams.
Mm-hmm. The weirdest thing on your desk right now?
Probably my reading glasses, which are a new development. They often just sit on the desk at the moment because I haven't quite made that transition to actually using them on a frequent basis.
Whereas once you start, you can't stop. Did you have a favorite movie?
Finding Dory.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee in the morning, tea in the afternoon.
Very good. So thank you very much, Helen, for your time today. It's been great having you in Coast to Cast. And thank you, everyone, for following us in one more episode of Coast to Cast. I hope you have enjoyed it. Please follow our podcast and give it a lot of stars in your review and help us spread the word. Thank you very much. Bye.